Lecture 5, Camus, The Plague and the Fall.
Camus' most graphic illustration of his concept of the absurd is in his novel, The Plague. It was published just after the Second World War. He wrote it during the war. What it gives us is a picture of the social dimension of the absurd, as opposed to the strange isolation of someone like Merceau, as opposed to the mythological individuality of someone like Sisyphus. On the face of it, it is a depiction of the Nazi occupation, characterized in terms of a mysterious disease that takes over a city. The Nazis were, of course, something of a plague to the French. And yet, the novel is set not in France, but in Algeria. And the idea of the German occupation is something that shouldn't be taken too seriously. It's too obvious an interpretation. But also, what tends to capture here is the impersonality of it all. In fact, the book came under considerable criticism for making Nazism into a faceless evil, something for which no Hitler or no particular individuals were responsible. But of course, the idea is that when catastrophe happens, sometimes we have to all face it together. And it doesn't matter what its precise cause. It doesn't matter whether someone is responsible. The real question, the existential question, is how we together will face it. Now, The Plague and the novel itself is actually borrowed from a novel by Daniel Defoe some years before. The Plague is something which is utterly impersonal. It is something which has no face. It can't be cured. It can't be prevented. It's not clear how one catches it, and it's not clear how one can avoid it. There's a sense in which it isn't even explained. It is diagnosed so that fairly early in the novel, the characters all realize that that's what it is. But the question about how one should live with it is the question that Camus wants to face. There are, of course, a number of alternatives. One can fight the plague, but what's most interesting about the fight is it's futile. It is, in any case, uncertain. Since we don't know exactly how to stop it, we don't know how to prevent it, it's not clear what one does. You can sort of perform all sorts of hygienic rituals, but as we know from our own smaller cases when we're fighting the flu, for example, very often these things don't so much give us symptomatic relief, much less anything that could count as a cure, but they make us feel as if we're doing something to take care of ourselves. One can try to escape, but of course, with the plague, what do you escape from? Where do you run to? Or you could take advantage of it. Sartre has a quotation, often quoted out of context, but it tells a lot. He says, "Each of us gets the war we deserve." And the idea is that, okay, there's a war on. You didn't choose it. In a sense, you can't do anything about it. But what you can do, in fact, what you have to do, is choose how you're to cope with it. And what this novel is about is how different characters cope with the plague, cope with this collective absurdity, and consequently, how they conceive of themselves and their lives in the face of it. Let me go through the list of characters, not the complete list, but there is quite an interesting spread, and what Camus does with them, I think, is illustrative of the kind of reactions that he wants to encourage us to consider. First of all, the hero of the story, and in fact its narrator as well, although we don't learn that until the very end, is a doctor, a Dr. Rieu, who is in the midst of the plague and firmly committed, dedicated as a doctor to doing everything he can to somehow fight it. But it's not clear what he can do. And of course, there's a sense in which he is the hero precisely in the sense that he throws himself into his work. He throws himself into the project of somehow coping with the plague, even though it is highly unlikely he will have any real impact. It's highly unlikely that he will invent a cure. But nevertheless, he considers it his identity to throw himself into his medical practice. There's a curious character in the novel who has the ironic name, Monsieur Grand. Monsieur Grand is anything but grand. He's the most ordinary character. He is a man, very simple, in a not very happy marriage, who is coping with his life as best he can. He has very little talent, but has nevertheless decided that he'd like to be a writer. And in a way, he's the sort of Sisyphus of the novel, even more than the doctor, because in his attempt to write this novel, he never gets beyond the first sentence, which he rewrites over and over and over again. But he's so involved in the sentence, in the language, in the aspiration to do the novel, that he never complains. He simply sees this as what he does. And there's a sense in which, looking back to Sisyphus, Camus tells us in the novel that one might well consider Monsieur Grand the hero. At the end of the novel, he ends up fixing the sentence, he says, by taking out all the adjectives. There's a character named Rimbaud, who is a journalist. Rimbaud is somebody who is really, literally caught. When he is doing a story in Oran, the city in which this takes place, suddenly the city is quarantined because of the plague. He has a wife to whom he's very attached, who is elsewhere. And so Rimbaud spends his entire time through the novel trying to escape, trying to get away, until finally Ryu convinces him in particular that that's not going to happen, so you better spend your time doing what I'm doing. The most fascinating character of the novel is a fellow named Taru. He's a combination of saintliness and cynicism, and I'm tempted to say that he is by far the character in the novel who most closely represents Camus and Camus' own attitudes. I said that Taru is cynical, but that's not quite right. What he has is an enormous sense of irony. And it's very interesting in Camus' works. Irony is not a feature in much in evidence, unlike, for example, in Sartre, who can often be ironic, and certainly unlike Nietzsche, who makes irony his specialty, as does Kierkegaard. But Taru's attitude towards the plague is that, yes, of course, one must fight it, but one must fight it with the full consciousness of the fact that this is an absurd endeavor. There's nothing one can do of any significance, and yet, nevertheless, much in line with Camus' philosophy, one must rebel against the absurd. Finally, there is a character named Cotard. Cotard is the scoundrel of the novel. He's the one who wants to make use of the plague for his own enrichment. At the very beginning of the novel, Cotard tries to hang himself, obviously unsuccessfully. But having recovered from what looks like a death, and now facing the plague, which is the death of possibly everyone, Cotard is the one who is the true cynic, and sees in the plague nothing but a chance to help himself. There's also a priest, Father Panelou, who quite predictably attributes the plague to God's vengeance, and points out that, of course, we're all sinners and now we're paying for it. He resembles no one so much as the chaplain in The Stranger, and in many ways it's pretty clear that Camus' response to him is very much like Meursault's response to the chaplain. The father denounces us all as guilty, and because we're guilty, the plague is our punishment. But Camus makes it very clear that this is an utterly unacceptable interpretation, and with some irony, he has the father himself die at the end of the novel, although not clearly of the plague itself. But the picture that we are all, in effect, guilty, that we are all, in effect, facing divine retribution, is a thesis that Camus here denounces. And one might ask the question, how exactly this jives with, for example, the sense of original sin that one gets in some of his other novels, and in particular towards the end of The Stranger, and we'll see in his next novel, The Fall. But the question, how we face death, of course, is an ancient question, one that the Greeks were obsessed with, one that we moderns generally tend to ignore or deny. Of course, we all know that we're going to die, and this is a major theme in existentialism. But accepting the fact that you're going to die and what that means, accepting your mortality, that's a very different matter. And when we face death together, as in the plague situation, that's a very real question about who we are and what we think of ourselves. What should we do about the absurd? Well, there's a picture here, an answer here, which we don't get in the earlier works we talked about, and that is we have to face this together. There's a very strong sensibility in Camus, even though it doesn't emerge in most of his novels and writings, a notion of solidarity, a notion of how we're all in this together. And although it doesn't come out as a major theme in other works, in The Plague it makes it quite clear that if we're to understand the absurd, if we're to deal with the absurd in a straightforward and honest way, one of the things we have to recognize is that it is the absurd that faces all of us. In a later essay called The Rebel, he says, "I rebel, therefore we exist." It is that sense of solidarity that he defends here. And it's that sense which the Dr. Ryu, in particular, best illustrates. Evil is typically faceless, even when it has a concrete face, such as, say, Hitler. There's a sense in which evil is inevitable. Catastrophe is going to strike all of us. We are all going to die, and in the end, perhaps humanity is going to be finished as well. But the question is, how do we understand this? Do we understand this with a kind of despair? Do we understand this simply with cynicism and dismissal? Do we just deny it? Or rather, do we live on the basis of it? Camus has a concept in the myth of Sisyphus, which applies very well here. He calls it philosophical suicide. Where philosophical suicide is the attempt to deny the absurd or escape from it, it can be done in a number of ways. Father Panelou, or the chaplain in The Stranger, illustrates one of them. The appeal to God, the appeal to an afterlife, the appeal to a world beyond this one is a way of denying and diminishing the evils that happen to us here. And if not saying they aren't real, for example, death isn't real because there's another life after this, nevertheless, it sort of shrinks them in significance. This life with all its sufferings is insignificant compared with the life of bliss which may follow. For Camus, that's philosophical suicide. It is not taking this life seriously. It is not living this life and all of its moments to the fullest. There are other forms of philosophical suicide. For example, I mentioned that Camus has some serious disagreements with some of his Marxist and communist colleagues. And one of them is the attempt to defend present cruelties and even massacres, such as were going on under Stalin, by the appeal to a future society, a utopian society. We should remind ourselves the word utopia means basically nowhere. The idea is that to think of your life now and your behavior now simply in terms of some abstract future is a form of philosophical suicide too. What The Plague is about facing our collective fate together and quite honestly coming to the recognition that even if we can't change that fate, we can't just sit by and let it happen, nor should we be as corrupt as the character Cotard turns out to be, and simply be a cynic and say, "I'm in it for me, and the others don't matter." In Camus' next novel, The Fall, we go back to a very individual character. Again, there's no sense of social solidarity, but there is, as you'll see, a certain kind of interaction of a perverse sort. It stars a character named Jean the Baptiste Clemence. The name is very strongly biblical, John the Baptist to begin with, and the idea of clemency or mercy. We meet Clemence in a very seedy bar in Amsterdam, and the geographical location here is quite significant. Amsterdam is, of course, one of the low countries. It is actually physically below sea level. Clemence, however, is French. He's Parisian. He lived in Paris, and in fact, he lived in a penthouse. So there's a very strong picture of high and low here. And of course, the title of the novel, The Fall, already tells us pretty clearly that what this novel is about is a character who goes tumbling down. From his penthouse in Paris, he ends up in this bar below sea level in Amsterdam. One might note also, Amsterdam is a city with a very curious and picturesque geography. If you look at a tourist map of Amsterdam, what you see is a series of rings, which are the canals, which expand outward. And in the middle is the red light district, the sailors' quarters, where the seedy bar that Clemence likes to hang out in is located. Thinking back in literature, it's pretty clear that what this could be made to represent are the circles of hell. And it's the inner circle of hell which is reserved for the worst sinners. So one might say that Clemence falls from the heavenly city, Paris, to something that is very closely akin to hell. In Paris, Clemence was very much a success. In fact, I think it's quite important to see that Clemence, as he describes his life, is really kind of a near-perfect human being. That's important because it is very easy to look at him and look at what's happened to him and say, well, of course, because he did this wrong or that wrong, or he failed at this or he failed at that. We're very quick to do that, and that's been true, back since Aristotle in his report of Greek tragedy, always trying to find the tragic flaw that makes the character in some sense responsible for his fate. But the way Clemence describes his life, and there's a trick there that I'll have to talk about in a few minutes, but the way Clemence describes his life, it's clear that, first of all, he was remarkably successful. He was a lawyer, and not just a lawyer. He was a defense attorney, and not just a defense attorney, but a defense attorney who devoted his career to the defense of what he describes as widows and orphans. In other words, the very poor, the oppressed, those who could not make a case for themselves, those who were often falsely convicted, or in any case, even if they were truly guilty of the crimes, they had no chance in the legal system. And yet, he was such a good lawyer, he would often get them off, and he would often make life easier for the people who were worst off. So, despite all of the lawyer jokes that we might tell today, as a lawyer, Clemence had an enviable position, a noble position, and he saw it back then as a truly noble profession. It's never clear where his money comes from. It certainly wasn't from his clients. But it's also clear that Clemence was quite wealthy. He drove a fancy sports car. He lived in a penthouse in the city. He lived in general quite well, quite elegantly. He was a hit with the women and makes it quite clear that his, shall we call it, social life was very full. In tune with the times, his behavior might be construed as a bit sexist. But of course, remember, we're talking about the 1950s in Paris. And what he was describing then was pretty much par for the course. But the idea is, and the important point is, that Clemence really had nothing wrong with him. He had a noble profession. He had great success. He had great social status. He lived exactly as he wanted to live in every conceivable sense. He was happy. But he falls. And to examine the nature of the fall is to understand something very important about human life. First of all, he explains to us what turned his life around, why he gave up his life and his career in Paris and ended up in Amsterdam as what he calls a judge penitent. Three trivial incidents. Let me describe them. The first, he got involved in a small traffic brawl, something along the lines of what we sometimes experience as a fender bender, nothing serious. But as so often, and given the Gallic personality, this was a cause for some temper, And a fight ensued between Clemence on the one hand and the driver of a motorcycle who had somehow offended him. Well, to put it simply, the motorcyclist gets in a sucker punch before Clemence is quite ready to fight. He is knocked down, certainly not out, at which point the cyclist simply gets on his bike and drives away. Seems to me a very small incident indeed. Most of us, if we should be caught in such an event, would brush ourselves off, grumble perhaps a bit, go out for a beer, or go home and take a nap, and that'd be pretty much the end of it. But it wasn't for Clemence. He feels humiliated, and humiliated in a deep sense that I think most of us won't understand. The second event. He's crossing one of the several bridges in Paris when suddenly behind him he hears a peal of laughter. Now, we've all had the experience of walking into a room and suddenly there's a burst of laughter. And it's almost an instinctual reaction, isn't it? We sort of look up and look around and try and see if people are laughing at us. It's a terrible thing to be laughed at. But most of the time, we look around and we realize, no, someone just told a joke or something funny has happened. It has nothing to do with us. They didn't even notice us. Well, Clemence looks around on the bridge, doesn't see anybody, so he has no reason to think that anyone is laughing at him. Nevertheless, the thought haunts him, the idea that he might be an object of ridicule. The third event is a bit more serious. But again, it certainly doesn't add up to anything like a reason to turn your life around. He's crossing a bridge in Paris again, this time on a dark, somewhat cloudy night. And as he's crossing, he dimly sees a woman standing off to the side of the bridge. And after he passes, he hears a kind of shriek and then a splash. And obviously comes to the conclusion the woman has probably committed suicide. Now, this is something that, if it were to happen to us, I guess the immediate rational reaction, I would hope the automatic reaction, would be to see if you can do anything, but in any case, make a phone call. Clemence doesn't. He just walks on. But as he puts it, there was sudden silence, and when he looked down, he saw nothing. And he realized there was nothing he could do, and so he walked away. But that final incident utterly undermines him. And we next meet him in Amsterdam. Now, in terms of the book itself, I should note that the language of the book is extremely eloquent. The Stranger is written in rather abrupt, matter-of-fact style, not only to fit the character of Meursault, but also because Camus at that time was enamored, as were a great many French writers, with some of the Americans, people like Hemingway in particular, who had this sort of short, straightforward style of writing. The Fall, by contrast, is a book that's written using the best and most complicated, most sophisticated twists in French grammar, in French eloquence. And Clemence, as a charmer, a very sophisticated, elitist charmer, in the book, charms us. The truth of it is that whereas in The Stranger, written in the first person, where we get to see through the character's mind to what he experiences, in The Fall, what we find is we're at the other end of a conversation. You might say it's a novel written in the second person. There is another character in the bar where Clemence does most of his talking, but the truth is that character has even less to say than many of the interlocutors in Plato's dialogues. Things like, yes, Socrates, oh, yes, Socrates, you're right, Socrates. He doesn't even say that. The truth, of course, is that the person in the bar is utterly irrelevant, transparent, that what Clemence is doing is he's talking to us. And what he gives us is a kind of confession. Where Meursault thinks very little, reflects very little, Clemence can't stop thinking. It's in him in particular where one might say, consciousness, reflection, becomes a disease. He hardly tastes the delicious Dutch gin that he's drinking throughout the novel. He hardly is cognizant of the weather, except in a purely descriptive sense. Everything is dwelling on his past and on the state of man. Everything is very philosophical. And what he does, basically, is he confesses. In fact, the whole novel can be read as a confession, where confession is something very interesting. Confession, of course, goes hand in hand with guilt. It's guilt that prompts confession. The question is, of what is Clemence guilty? And as I said in those three trivial incidents, nothing. At most, in the third, you might say, it was some kind of Good Samaritan type neglect. He should have made a phone call, and he didn't. But nevertheless, the whole posture is one of the ultimate sinner. And the idea that the novel is a confession to us, is really what the novel is about. What does he confess? Well, interestingly enough, what he does, he tells us the story of his life. But he doesn't just go back and say, well, here's a fact, and here's a fact, and here's a fact. What he tells us, and everything we get is through his current ongoing description, what he tells us is essentially the fraudulence of his prior life, the emptiness of the nobility of his profession, his hypocrisy in his supposed good works and so on. He judges, and most importantly, he judges himself. One of the themes that is played with through the novel, beginning to end, is the biblical instruction, judge not that ye not be judged. The question of judgment plays a huge role in this novel, just as it played no role in The Stranger. Rousseau never judges anything, and he certainly never makes moral judgments. Clemence is making moral judgments all the time, and in particular, he makes judgments about himself. He confesses his hypocrisy. He confesses his two-faced nature. He confesses that he pretended to be innocent throughout his entire existence in Paris, but now he realizes he's guilty to the core. What's this all about? Well, I want to argue, basically the idea is to ricochet to the reader and make these accusations he makes towards himself, in fact, hit us. There's a sense in which Clemence is a seducer. He's charming, he's eloquent, he has a good story to tell. But more than that, what he does is he holds a mirror up to us and he says, Ecce homo, look at yourself. Who are you? And I want to say that the strategy of the book goes something like this. If this is a character whom we all find enviable, if this is a character of whom we don't find a fatal flaw or a fatal action, if this character, who was quite literally on top of the world, who has all the worldly goods and so on that we would ever want, and in addition has that kind of psychological sense of self-righteousness and innocence that most of us strive for, if this character can come to the conclusion that he is ultimately guilty, that he is a hypocrite, that in fact he is a fraud, then what are we to think of ourselves? And as I talk about the fall in the next lecture, what I'd like to do is to try and make this strategy come to life and understand exactly what kind of philosophical tricks are behind it. Thank you.